Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, episode 79. We are dropping April 1st for an April 2nd issue of the journal. I hope everyone is buckled up for the latest and greatest in orthopedic research this month in JBJS. As always, Your Cases on Hold features the commentary, insights, and critiques that are the opinions of myself and my co-host. They do not reflect the judgments, determinations, or impressions of the editor-in-chief, the editorial board, the editors of the other constituent journals, the board of trustees, etc. This episode is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. It is that time of year. Get your learn on, see what's testable items are coming up, see what Kaiser Sose items people have selected, and really just prepare yourself or refresh yourself or just stay engaged with testable topics for the board certification process. As per the usual, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, and I wouldn't hold out much hope for the Credence tapes.
I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I won't say what I'm holding out for.
As always, you can find us on Stitcher, Castos, Spotify, Apple, Amazon. If you can't find us there, just go to jbjs.org. Be sure to like and subscribe. Share the podcast if you can. Spread the word. This day that we're recording is a momentous day for me because my book that I authored myself, An Insider's Guide to Academic Publishing in Orthopedic and Spine Surgery, was officially released today from Elsevier. So
applause.
That's awesome. It has all the secrets and tips and insights. And if you get the book, you'll always be published in JBJS. These statements have not been verified by the FDA, but you know what? Do with that what you will.
Not much of an FDA right now. So, hey, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. So it's a free for all. Like you can, it's also April Fool's, but this is a real thing. It's not a joke. You can check it out on Amazon from Shop Elsevier, Barnes & Noble, anywhere, any of your major booksellers should be available. Speaking of, you know, somewhat foolish behavior, I just want to take a second. It came up, we just had the Academy meeting. This didn't happen at the Academy meeting, but it had happened previously at meetings. And I just want to take a step back and refresh for everyone what it is that we're doing here. As Joe Pesci's character, Nicky Spilotro in Casino, tells someone else, I want to be fair because I don't think you really understand what it is that I do. I just want to refresh for our new listeners, for our old listeners. Obviously, there may be some people here who have been listening for 79 episodes. If so, we thank you. But what is it that we are actually doing here? What we are doing is we are providing some insights, some best practices, some entertainment around the articles that are published in JBJS and trying to help people contextualize the work that's published in the journal for your own edification, for your own practice, for your own research, whatever it may be. I have a lot of people who come up and say, like, you know, but most of the stuff you don't even like it. And it's not about like it or not like it. It's about giving insights into the work. And I want to caution against, I think I've done it in the past. In fact, I'm sure I have, research nihilism. You'd want to stay from research nihilism. Uli is a nihilist. He's exhausted. You don't be like Uli, okay? Research nihilism is basically, you can sit there with the hands over your eyes and your hands over your ears and just, I'll tell you the level of evidence of the study and you have your prepared talking point about why you don't accept it. If it's level 4, oh, there's no controls. If it's level 3, oh, it's retrospective. If it's level 2, oh, it's not randomized. If it's level 1, oh, it's an idealized population and there's no real world application. and then just rinse and repeat. So then we just go right back. It's just a cycle. And all evidence exists on a spectrum. And you have to decide for yourself in your research, in your clinical application, in your clinical practice, where do things line up? And that's some of the tools that we're trying to give to folks here, is that what are the sort of nuanced areas that you can look at to see how does this apply to your clinical practice? What are the things that you can look at to see, is this niche? Is it more generalizable? But it's all true. You want to get really meta. You want to go into the metaverse here. Everything is true and everything is not true. I mean, at the end of the day, what people are writing here, what's being published in the journal, these things happened. It's truth, right? That doesn't mean it's going to be your truth in your clinical context, though. And that's where the fine line of making those determinations come in. But I want to caution against research nihilism. I also want to caution against you accept everything. Or you just say, like, I'm only going to accept randomized trial. If it's a randomized trial, then for sure, I'm going to apply to practice. If it's anything else, I don't apply it. I think across the board, there's valuable level 4 studies. There are valuable level 3 studies. You don't want to be someone who is just constantly saying no, 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 because the field doesn't advance that way. But you also want to be someone who can, you know, when they're shown objective evidence of a finding, even if it goes against their own predetermined beliefs and dispositions, that they're willing to thoughtfully say, like, okay, I accept this. And maybe I will change my practice in regard to that.
So healthy skepticism.
Right. Yes. I healthy skepticism is always necessary, but you have to have your limits. And if you are seeing something objective and you can say, okay, there's an article in this month's journal where I initially started out saying, I'm not going to like this one. And after I went through it, I said, okay, well, you know what? I actually think there's some real value here. And that happens quite regularly. Even over the course of the conversation that we're having, not everything goes on hold. But at the same time, you don't want to be someone who just has their predetermined idea of how it's going to be. And you can't be, I know better than everything else, especially when there's objective evidence in front of you. There was this guy in my fraternity. His name was Brian. He had really long, straight red hair. He looked like Axl Rose with a goatee. And he was a notorious teller of tall tales. Like, he said he played the ukulele and he rode a unicycle. And he says that he worked over the summer in, tearing out houses that had burned down, and socks don't, he made this claim that, you know, socks are fireproof. Like, everything else was burnt out of the house, but all the socks were left. And we were sitting around and it was just like, Brian, that's ridiculous. And
that's he talked
like this, man. He was, no, I'm telling you, man, socks don't burn. And somebody took a sock and set it on fire with a lighter, and it's holding the sock in front of him, and the fire is moving up the sock. And he just looked at it and he said, agree.
Didn't believe it.
What kind of socks are those, man? don't be like Brian. Like, when it's right in front of you, you got to engage with the truth. All right, let's go to the top of the pile. That's enough of the soapbox. Starting with what's important, the rationale for a comprehensive and fully transparent database by Jupiter, and that's permanently free, as is our other what's important, this one in the arts and humanities, my personal journey from the oil field to orthopedics, treating drills. That's by Richter, also permanently free. Then we have the 2024 AOA, JOA Traveling Fellowship by McDonald. Functional outcomes after modern external ring fixation or internal fixation for severe open tibial shaft fractures by Solarchik. Healthcare costs for patients with a lower extremity fracture have increased disproportionately over the past 10 years. A medical expenditure panel survey analysis of total expenditure and out-of-pocket costs by Ratz, a comprehensive analysis of percutaneous screw fixation for metastatic lesion of the pelvis, outcomes of 107 cases by Goker, anterior attachment of the medial patellofemoral ligament, morphological characteristics by Cheng, also with an infographic and permanently free. Incidence of and risk factors for ileus following spine surgery by Jordan. And we're still not done. We're not done by, this is one of the largest issues we've seen in a long time. Classification of sagittal spinal pelvic deformity predicts alignment change after total hip arthroplasty. A standing and sitting radiographic analysis by Buckland. delayed onset neurological changes following posterior spinal fusion, a case series by Fletcher. Prevalence of cataractous changes in the eyes and chronic inflammatory changes in the hands among spine surgeons by Hijikata, permanently free. Universal clinical DDH screening complemented with targeted ultrasound is effective in Finland by Luoto, permanently free. Properties of tungsten carbide rings when compressed to failure or cut with a diamond grinding bit, a biomechanical study by Quinto, permanently free. Aspirin is as effective and safe as oral anticoagulants for venous thromboembolism prophylaxis after joint arthroplasty. A systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized clinical trials by Hong. And then the impact of adolescent idiopathic scoliosis on pregnancy by Sirhan. That's about it for us this week. I hope you enjoyed listening to the... Oh, wait. I feel like it's over. We haven't even started yet.
It's like we're done already. There's a lot of interesting articles, though.
I'm out of breath. Yeah, too many to choose from. All right, let's get into the headlines, though. So in the orthopedic news this week, outcomes for younger patients with femoral neck fractures by Wagner and colleagues with a comment and permanently free. So this was the article that I selected. It's what I would call a clinical retrospective obtained from a registry, delineating a multi-center experience with the treatment of patients with femoral neck fractures. Now, obviously, what's young and what's old, that's a sliding scale, just like the evidentiary basis we already discussed. And they set this here at 60. So it's patients less than 60, or really, I guess, 18 to 60. I mean, we're talking about adults. The aims of the study were to evaluate the outcomes of fixation of intracapsular hip fractures in younger adults, those less than 60 years of age, to assess factors associated with failure and to report patient-reported outcome measures in the long term. That's directly from the authors. They have a trauma database that's multi-center. Now, they say it's consecutive series of adult patients, which I think that's hard to define from a registry per se, because you don't know which center is not putting someone in there, I guess. But, you know, presumably they got everyone who met the inclusion criteria. How's that? I wouldn't refer to that as consecutive, but, and this is for individuals treated with over 10 years time window, 2008 to 2018. They have 112 patients out of 140 potential that were included in the analysis. And it follows sort of the rote clinical retrospective. They give it level 3 evidence. I don't really conceptualize how this, I would say this is level 4 evidence. It's basically a clinical retrospective of their experience of treating patients. 112 patients does not, you know, break down to much once you start getting into the subgroups. All of their analytic approaches are basically simple bivariate comparisons. They did say in the limitations, and this is more just sort of a friendly pointer, they say they're recognizing small sample issues with selection bias in relation to time to surgery, defining failure, and when or whether further surgery was undertaken. And they say attempts were made to account for these issues using regression analysis, although this was not possible given the relatively small, but correctly just small sample size and failure event rate. So, I mean, my recommendation is when you have limitations, if you are able to do something that you feel addresses the issue, then by all means, mention it. If you have something that doesn't actually address the issue, you shouldn't mention it. So saying like, we would have liked to do a more robust, we would have liked to do propensity score matching. We would have liked to do machine learning. We would have, you like to do all sorts of things that you can't do because of the limitations of your sample. I mean, just talking about it doesn't change anything. So I don't agree with that really being listed there. Although it's factually correct, it doesn't change the impression, which is that there's concerns for confounding by indication and selection bias. They just went through the limitations telling you that, you know, the small sample is limitation. And then the first line of the discussion says, this is large study of younger adult patients. I don't think it's that large. And obviously, there were a lot of limitations associated with the sample itself. So maybe that's some, you know, splitting hairs or semantics. But I think it's funny that they lead off saying it's a large study, and then they come back and say, "Oh, it's a small study, actually." Yeah, exactly. Ignore the man behind the green curtain. You know, they have close to 80% progressing to union. Most frequent reason for failure is osteonecrosis, which was in 14% of patients. those obviously who had failure fixation or other complications had inferior outcomes, health-related quality of life, patient-reported outcome measures. They do make an interesting hypothesis where they talk about two distinct types of hip fractures in adults less than 60, the high-energy risk-taking behavior that's more often seen in younger males, and then what they call lower-energy early fragility fractures in patients with advancing biological age, and that tends to lean more female. And then that group, they say that, you know, there's higher risk of fixation failure and potentially even higher risk of mortality, with a 7% reported at just under 7 years. So an interesting study, a clinical retrospective from a multi-center group, I believe in the UK. And I mean, ultimately, I think that this certainly, I would not be surprised if this shows up as testable items on you name it.
Another Kaiser Sose?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because you could definitely read through this and just be like, okay, yeah, the UK group, this is what they found. And then it's on the OITE and they're talking about, you know, mortality rates on your web-based longitudinal assessment. Yeah, I think so. All right. So we're now going into your headline, which is an opioid-free perioperative pain protocol is non-inferior to opioid-containing management, a randomized controlled trial by Turk and colleagues, with an infographic, 30 days free, and a comment. That's the JBJS perfecta, not the trifecta. That's when it's free forever. So this is just 30 days. So it's one tier down.
But it's still free for 30 days. So please.
Right. So get into it.
So it's always an orthopedic dream, I would say, at least now, is can we do without opioids? We've been moving slowly down to the time frame when I was a resident and we would give 120 pills at one time of opioids. And we've slowly ratcheted that down. So I discharged like 28 pills. And now can we go to zero? So this study was looking at an opioid-free perioperative pain protocol. And it found that's non-inferior to opioid-containing management in a randomized controlled trial. Well, the good news is you already know the answer. So what happens here is they looked at this novel opioid-free pain management pathway. They say novel. I'm not sure it's novel. I think a lot of places are using this, in all honesty. It's just basically a protocol without opioids. And they had five orthopedic subspecialty surgical procedures. Spine, they had ACDF and ACDA. Foot and ankle, they had hallucis valgus or rigidus correction. Total hip arthroplasty. Shoulder, they had total shoulder arthroplasty or reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, and hand, they specified it to first CMC arthroplasty. So they chose bigger procedures, I would say, not necessarily huge procedures, but they chose bigger procedures that would have some pain afterwards. So between 2017 and 2021, there was a total of 425 patients screened for initial eligibility, and 110 of them had to be excluded. So they had 315 patients in the final pathway that were either opioid-free, which is 157, or opioid-containing, which was 158. Now, the problem I had with this was that the sample size calculation as an RCT was assigned to assess the non-inferiority, and they used the pain scale, the numeric rating scale for 0 to 10, 10 being the worst pain, 0 being no pain, at 24 hours. So they said 24 hours is the line in the sand. We're going to say that's going to be our primary endpoint for this study. Well, the effect size assumed a mean pain score of 3.2 for the opioid-containing group and a mean pain score for 2.5 for the opioid-free group. They did a pooled standard deviation of 2.5, non-inferiority margin of 2 points. Again, they use a typical 5% alpha level, minimum 80% power. And they calculated as 50 patients per specialty in each group for a total of 600 patients, 300 patients in the opioid-free group and 300 patients in the opioid-containing group. Now, remember, the numbers are 315, so definitely lower than what the initial sample size calculation was. And I think it has to do with running a randomized controlled trial. It takes a lot of work. So all the patients watch an introductory video with physician-directed education, were asked to complete a resilience questionnaire. Every patient had a 5 milliliter blood test to confirm creatinine clearance, which is probably true prior to surgery anyway for most patients. And those with existing liver disease had to undergo a second blood test to evaluate liver enzymes. The medication regimens, if you have nothing else, if you don't read this article, what I would do is go to table 2 and table 3. Table 2 has the opioid-free regimen, and table 3 has the opioid regimen. And they're basically very similar, except that the opioid regimen had intra-op opioids as needed by anesthesia, and then dilaudid IV in the post-op recovery, Norco and oxycodone in the post-op recovery, and at discharge offered Norco and Percocet. But everything else was the same between groups, including acetaminophen, NSAIDs, gabapentin, et cetera, et cetera. And it did depend on which procedures as to which medications the patient got. They had, again, we talked about the primary outcome, the NRS, a pain score 0 to 10 at 24 hours. If they left before that, patients were contacted at 24 hours. And the pain was collected at 6 hours, 12 hours, the 24 hours, 2 weeks, 6 weeks, and 1 year after surgical procedure. Not that this opioid-free regimen would probably be impacting it 1 year, but anyway, they followed them up to 1 year, which is a long time. They collected all the stuff that you would imagine. Patient characteristics, they did collect something called comfort level. So the comfort level is based on pain, constipation, nausea, and vomiting. Satisfaction, are you satisfied with the overall pain control? Deviations from the pain management pathway, morphine milligram equivalents, readmissions, adverse events, and patient-reported outcomes. So not surprisingly, in a randomized control trial, the demographic characteristics were similar between the two groups. And the take-home message at their primary endpoint of 24 hours, the mean NRS for pain in the opioid-free group was 2, and the opioid-containing group was 4. But there was actually statistically non-inferior is what they said. Pain levels were significantly lower in the opioid-free group than the opioid-containing group at 12 hours and 2 weeks. That said, pain scores at 6 hours, 6 weeks, and 1 year were similar. The key thing that wasn't highlighted in their abstract was that 18.5% of the patients in the opioid-free group did require opioid medication for breakthrough pain. And the most common time point at which breakthrough medication was prescribed was 2 weeks after a surgical procedure, at which 10% of patients required a breakthrough opioid prescription versus only 7% of it required in the hospital. So it was really a post-operative pain, tolerated initially, really needed it afterwards. Patients in the opioid-free group had significantly greater comfort at 24 hours and higher satisfaction with pain control, again, not taking into account these breakthrough medication patients. Interestingly enough, constipation scores were similar between groups. You would think they'd be higher in the opioid-containing group, but they were similar and similar health statuses. No major events. There were 3 minor events in each group. For the opioid-free group, one patient had sundowning, one patient had difficulty sleeping and was given zolpidem and lorazepam, and one patient had gabapentin-induced delirium. I remember both groups did get gabapentin. Within the opioid-containing group, one had severe nausea and vomiting, one patient had pain and difficulty controlling pain, and one patient had sustained hypotension that required vasopressor support. There were no unplanned readmissions. So I think the take-home message for me was, take us with caution. This didn't reach its sample size calculation. But that said, the opioid-free management pathway was safe and potentially as effective, providing non-inferior pain control at 24 hours compared to an opioid-containing pathway. I would be cautious also on the procedures that were included in this. I wouldn't say make all your procedures opioid-free right off the bat. And there was a bunch of crossover of patients. So interesting information. I think we should move towards opioid-free, but we're not totally opioid-free yet.
Yeah, I think that the relatively high percentage on the crossover, close to 1 in 5, I think it's like 18%, something like that. And the not reaching the sample size that was necessary are probably things that shouldn't be ignored.
So from a true methodology standpoint, I do worry about these types of things. Yeah. So, you know, are the findings still relevant? Hard to say, but I will say that it is interesting to have an opioid-free regimen compared to an opioid regimen for many different specialties.
Yeah, and there are certainly a lot of surgeries that lend themselves, minimally invasive procedures, percutaneous procedures. There have been plenty of other randomized carpal tunnel surgery that's shown that a non opioid protocol performs as well, if not better, than those randomized to opioids. Yeah. So the face validity is there. That's certain. Let us move into the Your Case is on Hold featurette. This is nerve recovery in pediatric supracondylar humeral fractures, assessing the impact of time to surgery by Syed and colleagues with a commentary. So you don't have to take it for us, for those who are like, all they talk about is total joints and spine all the time. We're getting into some pediatric work here. I thought this was a very interesting study. It is something that I'm interested in, not just epidemiology, but also nerve recovery. This is something that's very important in the spine field, of course. And they were looking at individuals who presented with nerve-related symptoms in the setting of supracondylar humeral fractures among pediatric patients. One of my pediatric attendings said the nice thing about kids is you can just rub a banana on their head and they'll heal everything. But I guess that's not the case. I don't know. That was just his thing. That's just what he would say.
I mean, kiwi fruit. I mean, there's so many options.
Yeah, there's so many options. He was a pretty, meat and potatoes kind of guy. So kiwi and exotic, he wasn't going to go with the dragon fruit. It was conventional only.
I love it.
He had all sorts of sayings. Another one was, why go through a door when you can knock down the wall?
It's a lot easier to walk through a door.
He was against minimally invasive surgery.
Very interesting. It's like the sock being on fire, right? There is no fire.
Yeah, right. So the goal of this study was to look at surgical timing on time to nerve recovery and symptom resolution of nerve-mediated symptoms. The initial comparison is patients treated within 8 hours or more than 8 hours from injury. And that's a conventional, well-established benchmark. Like that's the early surgery is within 8 hours. It's like that for spinal cord injury, open fractures, all that, anything beyond, right? If you really want to do a study, you do the people that are operated on at 7:59 versus those at 8:01. But, we're not going to have a study like that, obviously. So predictably, those fractures that were able to receive surgery earlier had a faster nerve recovery from those treated late, the average being 30 days to recovery versus 61 days to recovery. And that was significantly different. On the basis of the anatomic nerve distribution, they look at difference in nerve recovery time between early and late treatment for single nerve injuries, and then in symptoms in multiple nerve distributions that were treated early. Again, they're getting into sample issues here because they didn't find a difference for single nerve injuries, but the p-value is very borderline. And then they did find one for the multiple nerve distributions. Ultimately, in their adjusted Cox regression analysis, mixed nerve deficits, so like sensory motor and time from injury to treatment of more than 8 hours, were significantly associated with delayed nerve recovery. Multiple anatomic nerve distributions were not significantly associated. And again, I think that just ties into part of it is showing, like, once you're accounting for other factors, because the point estimate for that multiple anatomic nerve distributions is very close to one. 0.97, essentially, which is really giving you a point estimate that's saying this is not an important finding one way or the other. So, if we left it at that, I would say, bravo, well done, and makes sense. But then they wanted to take it a step further, and they start looking at, well, let's look at 6 hours versus more than 6 hours, or let's look at 7 hours versus more than 7 hours. And then let's break it down to less than 6 hours, 6 to 8 hours, 8 to 10 hours, 10 to 12 hours. And they've got like all these subset analyses. I think the best studies are one question, one answer, one take-home message. And they had that. You could have stopped at the next to last paragraph of the results section, and it would have been chef's kiss. But they had to go into this, and it's just, when you start doing stuff like that, it's like, we understand the 8 hours. That's why I brought it up earlier. That's like the classic cutoff. That's the accepted clinical cutoff. What's 6 hours? What's 7 hours? What about 5 hours? What about 1 hour? I mean, if you set it at 1 hour, how many patients can even get to the hospital in the OR? And when they'd literally have to have the injury outside on the steps of the hospital, basically.
Like, I'm here.
Right? Yeah. They were visiting in the hospital and they had a fall and got the supracondylar fracture. So, what you're looking for here in a methodologic standpoint is a spline. You're looking for that point at which there's like things start to change dramatically, like earnings associated with college education. Like once you get through college education, you get a big spike in your earning potential. It doesn't matter if you got 4 years of college education, but you didn't graduate. Like you got to cross that threshold. And then once you do, there's a dramatic change. And that's sort of what they're looking for, but they're not going to be powered to find those associations effectively or to model the associations effectively. So in any of the comparisons where they're just dichotomizing like less than six versus more than six, you still have that long tail from, you know, whatever it is that was also present in the 8 hours. Like if it went, you know, 8 to 100 days, you know what I mean? Like that tail is still present. You've just added whatever cases were between 6 and 8 hours, or in the case of the 7 cutoff, then you just added one additional hour's difference. And you can see that in some of their point estimates there. There's a big difference between the 8 hour patients at the 8 hour cutoff, just to reflect again on it, 30 days versus 61 days. Now, again, there's going to be a long tail, and maybe some of that is weighted by the people who are really, really delayed for whatever reason. But so we got 30 days if you make the cut at 8 hours. If you make the cut at 7 hours, it's 28.5 days. So 1.5 days difference. And if you make it at 6, it's 25 days. So we're really just talking about 2 hours. It's like a 5-day difference. I mean, not making light or minimizing, you know, these kinds of things are concerning to patients, of course. And it's not like a light switch either. I mean, let's be honest, you know, neuropraxia is recover. It's sort of a gradual improvement. It's not like terrible, 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 terrible. And on day 25, bam, you're back to normal. The sun comes out and all say, that.
Ding, you're right? Done. You're healed.
Right. Like the toaster. So, you know, 5 extra days of mild symptoms or whatever it may be. I don't know how clinically meaningful that is. They don't have 95% confidence intervals for these. They're just using the IQRs, but the IQRs overlap by a lot. So I'm going to say that this is like all sorts of multiple comparisons, and the real clinical significance is at the 8 hours. And I would really leave it at that.
And no more extra prayer. So more is not better.
No, it's not. One question, one answer, one message. Okay, honorable mentions. Delayed surgery increases the rate of infection and closed diaphyseal, tibial, and femoral fractures by Subramanian and colleagues. This is with a comment and a visual summary. This is a study that used the Surgical Implant Generation Sign Network surgical database to study IM nailing for patients January 2018 to December 2021. They had close to 9,500 closed fractures, including the study, 58% femoral, 42% tibial, obviously a young patient population with an infection rate of 3.1%. Their goal was to assess the impact of surgical delay on the risk of infection, and specifically targeted to low middle income countries. Increasing delays are predictably associated with longer surgery duration and higher rates of open reduction. And these were associated with an increased risk of infection. They maintain the study quantifies the increased risk due to delays in receiving care, highlighting the importance of timely surgery. Next is the Thessaly Graft Index, an artificial intelligence-based index for the assessment of graft integrity in ACL reconstructed knees. Thessaly, or Thessalia, being a region of Greece. I believe it's where Philip of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father, is buried. This is by Chalatzis and colleagues. This cohort study included 24 patients with an isolated ACL injury that had been treated with a hamstring tendon autograft and followed for 1 year. They basically use AI-based index that they have named the Thessaly Graft Index to evaluate graft integrity following ACL reconstruction. And they maintain it is a tool that is able to accurately recognize an ACL graft rupture, and it correlates with KT1000 postoperative values and patient-reported outcome scores. Then we have a hip new standard. I think they're being a little bit tongue-in-cheek there. Improving osteoporosis care with inpatient administration of IV zoledronate. This is by Turner and colleagues. This was a study designed as a quality improvement initiative, an academic medical center in Portland, Oregon, over 2.5 years. Basically, their aim was to improve osteoporosis treatment with IV bisphosphonate therapy in eligible patients admitted for hip fracture. So this is a clinical retrospective catalog of their experience. The rate of zoledronate administration increased from about 35% to 75% once they got into their second cycle of the Plan Do Study Act. And they maintained their initiative was effective at improving osteoporosis diagnosis and treatment among older hip fracture patients. And the protocol development for administrating inpatient zoledronate after hip fracture is reliable and a way to predictably offer bone health care and secondary fracture prevention to hip fracture patients that they believe is scalable and capable of implementation at other institutions. That's about all there is for this week. We are for sure out of time. We'll try and do better next time. For those of you who stuck with us all the way, our tens of faithful listeners, we appreciate it. Spread the word. If you didn't like what you heard, tune in next time, because Dr. Chen will be leading the discussion. And hopefully wherever you are, everything is green and gold and ready to go. But here, as always, your case is still on hold.
Till next time.